Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So we are back. Welcome to the 2022, the first episode of the Science of Sport Podcast with myself, Mike Finch, and Professor Ross Tucker. And it has been a bit of a couple of months off that we've had. We've been traveling and doing all bits of different things and just planning for the year. So our apologies that we've been off air for a while. But we've got a bumper episode lined up for today, and we're going to be talking about something which has become very relevant in South Africa particularly, and we do apologize for those of you living in the very cold climes of the Northern Hemisphere in January, because down in Cape Town in South Africa, in the Western Cape particularly, it was reputed to be that we were the hottest place in the world on Saturday, with temperatures in outlying areas of around 44 degrees Celsius. And here in Cape Town, there was a lot of pool swimming and a lot of playing in sprinklers as temperatures reached the mid 30 degrees Celsius. But it has been a couple of weeks of quite severe temperatures here in Cape Town. And we thought, well, I know that we won't be able to, you know, for those of you listening up in the Northern Hemisphere, you won't be able to see the relevance of listening to this now, but certainly keep this one, because when your summers come around in the middle of the year, you can start getting into some of the detail around particularly what we're going to be talking about today, that is exercise and heat. And one of the subjects that we're going to be listening to, and one of the people we're going to be listening to, is a guy by the name of Matt Beers, who is a South African mountain biker. And an event that happened here in South Africa just over a week ago is called the Atacross Extreme Challenge. And it's called that because it's a very long 109-kilometer mountain bike race, which is normally held in hot conditions. But this year, conditions were touching 50 degrees Celsius at times. And here's a bit on what Matt thought of the conditions on the day.
Atacross was an absolute beast this year. It's a proper hard race without 40 degree average temperatures, but yeah, the heat made it pretty unbearable, and a lot of the riders, including myself, were dropping like flies. The average temperature was between, on whoever's GPS, is just between 38 and 40, and then at max was, you know, pretty much close to 50. So yeah, the heat was like something I've never experienced. I don't think anyone has ever raced in that heat, and it was quite scary. It definitely felt like your body was shutting down. I went a little bit too hard in the beginning, got the heart rate too high and the core temperature too high, and I think that kind of, yeah, my body just went into shock. And I was just about trying to get to the finish after that. It's just survival, you can't push any watts. I was going full gas, pushing like 320 watts, which is like endurance pace. So yeah, it was just, there's no amount of water or ice you could throw over yourself to get cool. It was just like this overwhelming feeling of heat and like claustrophobia. Well, for me, I was quite worried that I was doing damage to my body. I think some riders did get some damage, muscle damage and kidney damage, but luckily all is well. And I would have definitely hydrated a lot better the 48 hours leading up to it, and as well during the race would have just stopped at the first two water points, which I think Simon did, which was a really good call on his part. So yeah, he rode smart and was the smarter guy, won definitely.
So that was Matt Beers, and my apologies, not 109 kilometers, actually 121. I should know that as the editor of bicycling here. But yeah, certainly, as you can hear in his description of it, and don't forget, Matt is a man who has won the Absa Cape Epic last year. So he's a very highly ranked South African, not in South Africa, but also around the world. So he really is a top athlete and clearly under some distress. And Ross, I mean, it was one of those days where I'm not sure I would have pitched up at the start of a race like that.
I wouldn't have shown up. I wouldn't have made the trip. This race, for those who don't know, it starts, 2-3 hours out of Cape Town. I would have looked at the forecast and stayed home because there's very little upside to putting yourself through. What is the winning time? It's just under 6 hours, right?
Something like that, yeah.
I mean, and the rest of the guys at the back are taking 9-10 hours of exposure to 50 degrees.
Yeah.
There's no
I guess it's the challenge, though, isn't it? It's known as the hardest mountain bike day race in the world, they claim at times. So.
Yeah, but as they say, I was reading a book the other day on the SAS in the military, and they say any idiot can suffer. The point is to not suffer. And so the best athletes are the ones who prepare specifically for the conditions. But how do you prepare for 45-degree? And like, this is exposed, right? This is not under tree cover. This is exposed to the sun for 6 hours at over 40 degrees. There's no way that's safe to do. And it's actually testament to how amazing human physiology is that as many people finished it. Because I looked at the results the other day and hundreds of people made it.
Yeah, 50%, I think.
50% failed. Yeah. But I'm saying, if you look at it with a glass half full, 50% can actually do that. That's how astonishing human physiology is in the heat. We are thermal, like, miracles. Mm. In fact, it's one of the things that makes humans what we are, is our ability to thermoregulate. And that's kind of the theme of this podcast, but it is amazing. But the conditions on that race would have canceled most races around the world. There's no doubt.
Yeah. He talks a little bit at the start about, I've never ridden in conditions like that.
Mm.
I guess that's a pretty key point, because he's got no reference, and his body's got no reference to that sort of level of heat.
Yes, and the key thing is acclimation. Like, as we dive into the theory and what happens to the body, and I guess the most important thing, if you're listening to this, is I don't want it to happen to me, so what's the prevention? By far the most effective two things are fitness and adaptation. So fitness, Matt Beers has got more than most humans in the world. I mean, the guy, as you said, he won the Epic, 3 months ago?
Yeah.
So there's no fitness issue here.
Yeah.
But the thing is, are you adapted to the heat? Now, he's riding that race in the middle of his summer, so he probably is adapted to the heat. Because if he's on the bike for 4 or 5 hours a day, then guaranteed in the month leading up to that, he is heat adapted, but not to that degree. Nobody would have been.
I was going to say, can you be heat adapted to that level of temperature?
No, so by scale, everyone in that race is in uncharted territory. Mm. So, of course, that's why he's accurate when he says we've never done anything like this before. But the fitness, the cardiovascular adaptation, and the heat adaptation in elite athletes is so good that they are closer to being adapted than many others. And that's part of the reason why. Guarantee you the attrition at the back is way, way, way worse than at the front.
Yeah.
And it's also why when we watch, say, an Olympic marathon, we expect the worst, because we project our mortal physiology onto the elite. They're so well trained. And what we'll discover is that many of the training benefits that you get in response to elite high-level endurance training are the same as what you'd get in response to heat. So there's considerable overlap, which makes an elite athlete almost heat immune. But again, there's a point at which that fails, because how do you get prepared for 40 degrees at the start line, never mind 50 at the finish?
Do we know how the body does adapt? I mean, do the veins get thinner, or I mean, how does an elite athlete become more heat adapted than an untrained athlete?
Well, everyone can adapt. So your training and performance status doesn't influence your ability to adapt to the heat. Mm. That adaptation takes many forms. Primarily, they're cardiovascular. And again, when we start to explore what happens in the heat, what the challenge to the body is, you'll understand why this happens. But for instance, your plasma volume goes up. So a fit athlete has got a higher plasma volume. If you put that person in hot environments often, it goes even higher. And you and I, by the way, as non-elite athletes, we would get the same benefit if we spent 2 hours a day in the heat riding like it is right now in Cape Town.
Yeah.
So plasma volume goes up. Your stroke volume, which is the amount pumped by the heart, every contraction is going up. Your ability then to cool off is higher because you're sending blood to the skin. Remember, that's how we lose heat.
Mm.
We also lose heat through the evaporation of sweat, and our sweating capacity goes up as we are heat adapted, which then is buffered or offset by the fact we've got more plasma volume. So you can see these things all interconnected. Our core temperature is lower at any given exercise intensity as a consequence of all this. And that is ultimately what drives heat adaptation, in addition to certain neurological changes that are happening, mediated by molecular factors and perception, the result of which is that the first day of a hot spell, you feel absolutely terrible. By the seventh or eighth day, you've become accustomed to it. Now, that's just the English way of saying physiologically adapted and familiar with what you're experiencing. So the point I want to make there is that all the responses to exercise training are similar to heat, but they just differ by scale, and the heat amplifies them a little bit more of a challenge on the cardiovascular system, on the sweat response, on the heart, on the brain. Mm. And so training in the heat induces changes that go over and beyond, above and beyond the changes induced by training, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it would be fascinating to actually study sort of a person living in Europe versus a South African bushman who lives for most of his life in extremely hard and hot conditions. And the physiology of those two people must be almost like they're not from the same species anyways.
Yeah, the sweat capacity, for example, can go – it changes enormously as we get adapted to the heat. And in order to facilitate that sweat response, we need to also have the ability to send more blood to the skin, because that's going to take heat where it needs to be lost at the surface of the skin. The plasma volume can go up by, I think, 16-17%. That's within the first week of exposure to the heat. So in these individuals who've lived and been adapted through generations, you'll find like that there are major, major cardiovascular differences between them and
us. So it's as short as a week that you can see changes in adaptation. That's many quite extraordinary.
Yeah, many of the cardiovascular adaptations take only about 7 to 10 days.
Oh.
The research on heat acclimation suggests that you give it 14 days or more, because there are others that require a little bit more work, shall we call it, in order to happen. But the plasma volume and the heart rate related changes happen within the first 7 or 8 days.
Sure.
It depends a lot, like most things in sports science, on exactly what you do in those 7 or 8 days. And there are different models for heat adaptation. So, for example, I've seen studies where they'll make guys go 60 minutes at 70%. And sure enough, on day one, they all fall off at 45 minutes. They can't get to 60.
Mm.
By day three, they're getting to 55. By day six, they're getting to 60. And by day 10, they're getting to 60 relatively comfortably.
Mm.
But the problem with that is it's the same workload the whole time.
Mm.
And so in actual fact, the stress is less over time because they're getting better at handling it, if that makes sense, relatively speaking.
Yeah.
So then you might want to do some self-paced stuff. The dilemma for athletes, and I mean now we're getting on to prevention a bit, is if I've got a race like Atakwas or any other marathon in the heat, an Olympic marathon, is how much am I willing to sacrifice training quality during the time that I'm adapting to the heat? Because I can't go out and do the normal training session because the heat's going to stop me. So there's a trade-off between focusing on how do I drive my ability to adapt to the heat and actually keeping my performance ability in my event.
Mm.
And so that's why you probably need longer, and the best athletes would probably allocate a month or more towards getting into a hot environment ahead of the Olympics and trying to manage that smooth transition of training into the heat.
He talks a little bit about feeling like, I mean, let's not forget that despite what he says in that interview or that voice note, he finished third in the race.
Yeah, so not bad.
It wasn't a complete failure for him, but he would have been the firm favorite going into it. He talks about he's feeling like his body was shutting down.
Mm.
That's quite dramatic to say something like that when you're still racing at the sharp end of the field.
Yes, but I know from my stalking you on Strava that you cycled yesterday at 11:30 and on Saturday at 1,
yes,
when it was also the hottest place on the planet, and it was a mistake. And I guarantee you felt the same as he did.
Well, I did it yesterday as an experiment because we were doing this podcast today. And I can tell you the one thing that we're going to get into this, and maybe that's the next point we talk about in terms of Matt, is that I tried to ride relatively easy yesterday, but I couldn't get my heart rate up. But I was exhausted after a ride that normally takes me around about 2 hours. Yesterday, I did that same ride in 2.5 hours, and my average heart rate was not beyond zone 2, zone 3. But I actually couldn't get it any higher than that. And at points in the last half hour, I was stopping on the side of the road under the tree just to cool my body down because that's how hot it was. I've never experienced that before.
But you can see how if you were to relate that to someone, you would describe it potentially as shutting down.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
And that's why I say beers and you, for all the differences, and it was the same for me a couple of weeks ago, a week and a half, I planned to go early morning and I had work come up. Next thing I said, well, I'm still going to do the ride, but I only left at 10:30 and I finished at like 40 degrees. And it was the same sensation.
I needed 100 Ks in 4 hours or something.
Yeah, it was like 120 K or something, 5 hour ride. And towards the end of last year as well, I did a day long ride thing and same story. And you just, it's difficult to explain to someone who's never been in that situation, but it's as if a car that usually has 5 gears has had its top 2 gears taken away from it.
Absolutely spot on.
And it can run, in third gear quite comfortably. But the moment you throw a challenge in its way, it can't get over that challenge. So I remember riding with these two youngsters on this one ride, and they were fresh because they just started and I was into my 10th hour or something. And the moment we hit a bump, even a bridge over a road, I got dropped because I just could not go 1% harder, but I wasn't going hard. And so it's really interesting to listen to Matt Beers say that he said, and I think his words were full gas, but he was only able to go 320 watts, which, okay, that's beyond most people's full gas. But for him, it's endurance temper, but that's maximum effort.
Yeah.
So something has constrained his ability to go harder. Same as what you felt at the weekend, same as what I felt. And that's the most, for me, that's the most interesting thing about exercise in the heat is that the body actually is trying to protect us from ourselves, even in a race situation. I mean, he had everything to go harder for. He could have come first, but he couldn't because the physio, his brain's saying, Matt, let's not do this to ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so for a brief history lesson, I'll give it to you in 1 or 2 minutes. The theory used to be, and in fact, when I started honors, this was the prevailing theory, was that when we exercised in the heat, the main challenge was a competition between our skin and our muscles for blood. You can imagine our blood supply is finite. It's limited. We don't have infinite amount of it. But when we exercise, we need it in the muscle. And when we're in the heat, we need it in the skin. So there's a tug of war that is established between those two circulatory bodies or beds, muscle versus skin. And the theory used to be that at some point we failed to meet the demand in one or the other, and that's what caused us to either overheat if we couldn't get the blood to the skin, or to fail exercise if we couldn't get the blood to the muscle. Make sense?
Yeah.
Then in the 1990s, a number of clever studies were done where they showed that in most circumstances, not all, and this theoretical tug of war limit does still exist, but in most circumstances, our body is quite capable of meeting the demand for skin and muscle blood flow at the same time.
In normal conditions.
And in hot conditions, in normal exercise performance. So the only time you can manipulate this to cause the system to fail is if you do repeated high-intensity exercise. Because when you do high-intensity exercise, you need a lot of blood in the muscle. And if you do that in the heat, then you also need a lot of blood in the skin. Then that tension, that theoretical tension, is realized and it becomes a real problem. But when we're outdoors doing moderate, low-intensity endurance exercise, it's not really a factor. So a number of studies came out showing that this was not really the thing that caused us to fail in the heat. Instead, what was discovered, and most of that research was coming out of Scandinavia, which I've always found interesting. It's why have they led the world on heat? You'd have thought that would have been... But they are the leaders. You can go all the way back to the 1950s, Nielsen, and then I think it was his daughter in the 1990s and 2000s, Bodil Nielsen, was the preeminent heat researcher in the world. And they started doing these really cool studies, amazing work, where they were measuring the brain during exercise in the heat. So they'd make reasonably trained cyclists go at 40 degrees Celsius to exhaustion and check what happened in the brain. EEG, blood flow to the brain, EMG activity at the muscle. And to sum up very quickly, what they found is that at the point at which these people in the laboratory said, I'm done, I can't go anymore, certain things were always present. Number one is their body temperature was always 40 degrees or higher. So there seemed to be an upper limit. Remember your temperature as you're sitting listening to this, assuming you're not exercising as you listen to this, is 36.5, 37 degrees.
Yeah.
Failure happens at around 40 to 41 degrees Celsius, depending on the person, their level of motivation and the situation. They also found that blood...
So your body can go up to 40 degrees Celsius during exercise, which if you had to take a temperature of somebody right there trying to get into a store halfway through a ride, they'd tell you you had a COVID, wouldn't they? Because your temperature would go up.
Well, they wouldn't pick that up because that is the most useless test ever developed by humans. Yeah. It's so rubbish. We still do that in South Africa, and I can't understand why. But anyway,
what you're saying is that the body temperature can get to that point during exercise.
If we could measure it properly, either with a ingestible, these days the military's developed these tablets you can ingest, and they measure your temperature. They submit a Bluetooth signal to a device. It's like a little capsule. If we could measure it there.
It's a bit more comfortable than the anal one.
Than the old rectal thermometer. Yeah, bend over and ride. Or tympanic, if you want. A little bit less accurate. Obviously, the closer to the center of the body you are, the better, right? You would measure someone at, even when we do our rides, and we're by no means trying to win any races, we would be 38, 38 and a half, on a hotter day, 39, 39 and a half, and not feel at all like anything was wrong. I've said on this podcast somewhat jokingly, but it's worth repeating because I think it's quite profound, is if you measured yourself when you were sheltering under the shade of a tree on Sunday, your breathing rate would have been 41 breaths a minute, heart rate 155, body temperature 39, you'd be sweating profusely. If you were in a hospital, they'd call a priest.
Yes.
But in fact, in that situation, you're okay. Okay, you're not comfortable, but you're okay. When we finish our Friday rides and have a beer at the pub to finish, everyone in that situation is overheated, breathing hard, sweating profusely, and would look, based purely on numbers, like something catastrophic was wrong. But in the body, this is actually normal. And that's quite an important point to bear in mind.
It is, because I think that I've always thought that your body always tried to maintain sort of homeostasis in terms of temperature. So everything was based on regulating, keeping your temperature and everything else in your body at a balanced level. I didn't realize that you actually went up in temperature. And I mean, I know that your heart rate goes up and all that sort of thing, which would, again, be an indication of exertion and the effect that it has. So that is interesting that the body's able to have this range.
And it does defend temperature, but it just allows that range to be wider when we exercise than when we're at rest. Because, you know, we're all overly familiar with infection and flu and fevers by now, but when you have a fever and your mum used to say you're hot, I can feel that. That's also a similar phenomenon where your body has allowed the temperature to go up in response to infection, and so you get this fever response mediated by inflammation, and it's called hyperpyrexia and so on. So exercise allows the same thing. I have a friend and former colleague who did a study at the. We have this massive cycle race every year, usually March. And he gave a bunch of people these ingestible tablets, measured their body temperature during what for some people was 3 hours, for some people was 6 hours. And the universal finding is that within the first hour, his body temperature goes from 36.5 to 38.5, 39, and then it just stays there. So it's almost like there is still regulation. It's just at a new level, of 39. And it's only when things go wrong, and that we'll get onto what that involves a few different ways, that it now hits 40, 41, and then eventually you're in Tom Simpson territory, heat stroke territory, which again, Matt alluded to. Some guys in that race, I know a youngster was spotted by one of the support runners weaving all over the road, the relevance of which I'll get to shortly, and then eventually fell over, hit his head. They said, no, you're off to the hospital. And he was actually quite badly affected by the heat.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Sure.
So that was something of a diversion. What the Scandinavians recognized is that the commonality at the point of fatigue in their studies was central nervous system change, and linked to it was behavior change. These folk would sometimes forget their name. They lost balance. Their coordination was gone. That's why I said a guy weaving sideways across the road like he's drunk, that's a classic sign of heat stroke.
Yeah.
Because once your brain gets hot, it fails to control your muscle movements and your coordination. There are famous, famous clips. If you have a moment, go look up Gabrielle Anderson, 1984 Olympics. Look up Jim Peters, 1954 Olympic Games. Look up Callum Hawkins, Brisbane Commonwealth. Sorry, not Brisbane. Gold Coast Commonwealth Games.
Mm.
You'll see guys suffering from the later stages of this heat stroke, and they can't run in a straight line. They look as though they've been paralyzed on half their body. Their coordination is gone, and they keep falling down.
CBC cameras also recorded Englishman Jim Peters' valiant attempt to win the 26-mile marathon.
And late that same afternoon, stricken Englishman entered the gates of Empire Stadium to write an agonizing chapter into the history of international games.
Dazed and dehydrated, he collapsed just 220 yards short of his goal inside Empire Stadium, with the nearest competitor miles behind him.
A stunned, horrified crowd of 35,000 watched in silence as Peters was carried off.
I also remember Paula Newby-Fraser happening to the Hawaii Ironman. She was collapsed and just having water poured over, and that was a mile from the finish.
Exactly. So we've all seen it. There was a Japanese athlete I remember seeing. Someone from NCAAs did it. Joshua Cheptegei, when the World Cross Country Champs were held in, was it Mombasa? I forget. It was in East Africa.
Yeah, somewhere in Kenya. I do remember that.
He attacked with about 4K to go, and with 1K to go, the same thing happened to him. And he looked like he turned to stone.
Is that overheating, or is that heat exhaustion, or is that – well, maybe we should just define this.
Yeah, yeah.
That to me feels like somebody's gone so hard they've overheated, but there is heat exhaustion and heat stroke.
Right. So
maybe you can break that down and explain what those all mean.
So they talk about exertional heat illness that exists, generally thought of as a spectrum from mild to severe. On the mild end would be things like I feel hot, like we had at the weekend, right? Then you get heat exhaustion, where your body temperature would be between 38.5 and 40. Now, again, that's not a red flag, because everyone who finishes an endurance event is between 38 and 40, but they don't have heat exhaustion.
Mm.
But what you often find heat exhaustion presents as is dizziness, slight confusion, low blood pressure. Why? Because your body is sending so much blood to the skin to try and cool you down that your central pressure falls. So that's in part responsible for the dizziness. Nausea. They feel like they've got a fever or the chills because they're trying so hard to lose that heat.
Mm.
And so that's heat exhaustion. Heat stroke. Now we moved from the mild and the middle to the very far extreme of the spectrum. This is the worst case scenario. Is where you actually get potential for multi-organ failure. You get central nervous system symptoms. So now you get major confusion. These people often don't know where they are, who they are, what they're doing.
And these are on the same spectrum. Exhaustion versus stroke is on the same spectrum of heat.
Yeah, so heat stroke is now the body temperature is over 40,
right.
Sometimes in 41 degrees. Person often loses consciousness. I've spoken earlier, they lose coordination. They stumble and fall over. They can't lift themselves back up. They are confused. They don't recognize their own. I mean, there are stories. They don't recognize their own family members on the side of the road. And when you get that combination of very elevated body temperature plus the neurological symptoms, that's how you distinguish heat stroke from heat exhaustion. Now, with heat stroke, this is a life-threatening medical emergency because it causes all kinds of circulatory-driven inflammatory responses, which cause leakage of toxins into the cells, into the blood, and eventually can lead to multi-organ failure. And in fact, heat stroke is the third most common cause of death during exercise in U.S. sport.
Wow.
Behind cardiac events, like sudden death, we've done that on this podcast, and neck and head trauma. Then comes heat stroke. The most common...
Well, I suppose it sounds like it's high, but that's relatively speaking, because even those other ones are fairly low.
Yeah. Like this is fire and brimstone now, literally. Yeah. But it's not...
Excuse the pun.
It's not super common, but I'll tell you some stats in a moment. the one I did want to say is the sport that most commonly has it is American football, because particularly in the southern U.S. states, they start their preseason camps for college football in probably August, September. And then they wear heavy padding and clothing and helmets, and they train at 30, 40 degrees Celsius. What's that, 100 Fahrenheit? Mm. And so that's actually the most common place that you find these heat strokes in American sport. Incidents-wise, there's a race called the Falmouth Road Race. I don't know if it's on Cape Cod up on the northeast coast, but it's a 7-mile, 11K, I think, race. Run more or less in the hotter part of the year. I saw a paper there. They're saying 2 per 1,000, which is unbelievably high.
Wow, okay.
That means every 500th person, they reckon, is getting heat stroke. Now, I don't know that that classifies as the most severe heat stroke, life-threatening.
Mm.
Because we've done work at the medical tent of our two oceans and comrades. Admittedly, they're a 56-kilometer and 90-kilometer racer, so the intensity is really low. You wouldn't expect heat stroke with low intensity. But we get one every 5 or 6 years. So
you've got a lot of exposure in those races, don't you? Because you're out there for a long time.
Right. So to some extent, the intensity might be offset by the fact that it's 10, 11 hours versus in Falmouth, it's 7K. I mean, for most people, it's 30 minutes. But yeah, 2 per 1,000 is crazy high.
Wow.
even in Boston, I saw a stat, it's 2 per 10,000. So that's 1 every 5,000 people, which is pretty high if you think about it. I'm not sure why the US reports such high numbers and we don't. Maybe it's in part acclimation related. Yeah. But yeah, that's heat stroke, and it is a medical emergency, and it kills people, so it has to be taken super seriously.
And does this all fall under heat exhaustion, or is heat exhaustion just another term for?
These are all exertional heat illness related syndromes or complications. Heat exhaustion is one of them. It's mild. Heat stroke is the most severe of them, which is potentially fatal. And if you don't cool those people off quickly, their prognosis is not good at all.
Yeah.
And the faster you cool them, the better, which is why most of these races in the heat now would have ice buckets and baths at the finish line. And if someone comes in like that, you just throw him straight into ice. And you basically, I mean, you try and freeze him to cool him down.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine that. I mean, for all of you that have competed or exercised in a lot of heat, just diving into a pool or taking a cold shower is the most wonderful thing. Mm. I always worry whether my heart's going to explode from the change in temperature.
That doesn't happen.
Is that a misnomer?
Yeah, that's a misnomer.
Yeah. So I can jump into the pool with ease then.
It's the best thing for you on a very, very hot day if you're feeling that way. In fact, it could save your life if you were in heat stroke realm, but you probably wouldn't be making the choice to jump into the pool
exactly.
if you were there. I mean, I remember just two quick stories. One, I met a guy who used to do a lot of this for the military. He said when you had a heat stroke out in the military, because you can imagine they get it a lot, and you've got no cold water and ice, they used to fly a Black Hawk over the big helicopters.
Oh, wow.
Used to fly a Black Hawk 10 meters off the ground over the guy and just blast him with downforce, the downdraft of the... to try and get wind cooling, because that's your next best option after water and ice.
God.
And the other story I remember is we were in the medical tent at Two Oceans, and they brought a guy in. He collapsed on the course, not after, which is a key differentiator. Lots of people collapse after racing, but if you collapse during exercise, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And they brought him in, put him in an ice bucket, and for the next half an hour, he continued to get hotter.
Wow.
In a full body ice bath. And then you look at that and you go, that's some seriously messed up metabolic activity, because when you're in basically 2 degrees Celsius, let's call it water, and you're still overheating, that means your internal molecular biology is producing heat at an unbelievable rate. You can imagine what's happening there.
How does a medical person then differentiate between somebody who might have a heart problem or a heat-related illness? Because they could present as fairly similar symptoms.
Yeah, because especially if you come in at 40 degrees Celsius and 40 degrees Celsius. But I think, look, part of it's the temperature, 41. You treat, you don't
Chilling
if
heat,
you hear
yeah.
hooves, you don't look for zebras, right? If you see 41, you don't look for heart. Remember, that if it's a sudden cardiac arrest, then you look for the cardiac signs of that. Heat stroke, the hearts are still beating.
Mm.
So that would probably be the main thing. I mean, I'm not an emergency physician at those races, so I'd be the last person you'd want to ask that. But yeah, so that's heat stroke, and that's a disaster, and that's why guys like Matt Beers, it's right to be scared.
Well, he talks about, we can move on to this now. He talks about, he was worried that he was going to do long-term damage, and he talks a little bit about his muscles and his kidneys. Is that realistic fear?
That's realistic, not only in the long term, but short term. I mean, we've already spoken about what can go wrong. The other condition that is often happens with this is something called rhabdomyolysis, which is basically where your muscle fibers are broken down. Now, that shouldn't happen. And when they do break down, you get leakage of all those contents into the blood, and it presents with blood in the urine. So if you ever exercise and you have a lot of blood in the urine, that's a very potentially serious sign.
Sure.
And one of the conditions that can cause that is rhabdomyolysis. Related to that could be kidney problems and kidney damage. So those
are. And is that short term, or are there potential long term damages?
They present in the short term, and it's not really known if that's related to heat stroke. Other, by the way, rhabdomyolysis can also be caused by excessive alcohol intake. I mean, as in a lot. And also physical trauma. Car accident victims often present with rhabdomyolysis because the collision just damages the muscle to the extent, the same way that heat and extreme exercise in the heat can do. Whether there are long-term consequences is interesting. I was at a conference in London once, and I met one of the world leaders on this heat stroke work, a guy called Douglas Kasser. And he actually got into the field because he was quite a good athlete. I think it was either at school or university, and he suffered heat stroke and said he's never been the same. And his working theory is that once an athlete goes to the extremes of a Callum Hawkins, Jim Peters, who's that on Gabriel Anderson, and you've actually gotten heat stroke, you never get better. You can exercise again, sure, but you can never quite go to the limit that you went to get that heat stroke in the first place.
Sure. It's like your body doesn't want to go there.
Yeah, it's almost as though it remembers it and doesn't want to go there. I've not seen research that tracks these individuals for a long period, but that was his theory for it. Yeah. So yeah, there is potential for long-term damage. Of course, if you don't treat heat stroke, the long-term damage could be
pretty fatal.
That's pretty permanent then. Yeah.
So we're going to get into some of the more details around heat policies and heat indexes, etc. But let's just stick to Matt just for the moment.
Yeah.
He talks a little bit about hydrating before. You should have drunk more than 36 hours before that. Comments on that? Can you store water like a camel?
No. So all you would be doing there is you'd be asking your kidneys to work a little bit more the day before, and you'd just be peeing out clearer water and reabsorbing less of it.
Yeah.
So no, that doesn't really work. What may help is the ingestion of very, very cold liquid or ice slushies or slurries, if you wish, during exercise.
Mm-hmm.
Because A, the surface area of ice slurries is so high, and B, they're so cold. So they literally cool you directly. As they move through your mouth, down into your stomach and into your gut, they literally cool you down just in the same way that sitting in a bucket of ice does, except it's from inside.
Right.
So that might have some benefit. So
that's interesting you talk about that, because when I went riding yesterday and the day before, I put my water bottle into the freezer, and I thought to myself, well, having water obviously is hydration, but doesn't make any difference whether it's cold or not, because obviously as the ride goes on, it ends up tasting like warm sweat.
It's like drinking tea by the
fridge. Yeah, but I suppose it's still hydrating you, but there actually is a benefit to having that cold water
If it's cold enough and if you can consume it often enough. But the problem is that sip or two, you know, it's 150 milliliters, 200 mils, is being added to a 70, 90, 100 whatever kilogram body with so much body water and heat that it really is like almost the drop in the proverbial ocean.
Yeah.
So unless you can continue to do it repeatedly, it probably isn't going to make a massive effect. The bigger difference is, and I'm sure you've experienced this, is perceptual. Is that to drink something warm actually is just almost makes the situation worse.
Horrible. I know. Yeah.
So to have the option of something cold makes quite a big perceptual difference. And as we'll discover shortly, when it comes to heat, below the heat stroke threshold, perception is reality. Perception is probably the main thing that drives performance. And the failure to perform is how hot you feel, not necessarily how hot you are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the pre-hydration thing that Beer spoke about, not really. Drinking during, as long as it's cold and often, it's a tiny effect. And then if we rank these things, the pre-hydration is nowhere.
Yeah.
Fourth or fifth on the list, I'm going to lose count. Next up, let's call it, would be drinking during. Pre-cooling strategies can be quite effective. So that means making sure that I start with a lower body temperature than I normally would. And that can be achieved either through ice buckets, ice bath immersion before exercise, warming up in an ice vest. And in fact, if you watch the Olympic Games, you will now see most of the developed countries will do warm-ups in these ice vests that are designed to try and let them warm up the muscles but keep the core cold.
Yeah, you see in the Tour de France a lot where they're in those time trial bikes
exactly.
with the vests on and they put those vests. Yeah.
Now,
so the core is cooler, but the legs are still getting warm enough to race.
Which is important because cold skin and cold muscles can reduce the contractility of your muscles. So they don't produce as much power. And that's why, in fact, pre-cooling strategies generally are shown not to work for sprint exercise.
Okay.
Because A, there's no thermal limit anyway. No one's going to overheat in a 400.
No.
And B, you actually probably, you get more downside because you cool the muscles and the skin potentially off and you want them actually to be quite hot. But the moment you start doing endurance exercise, then that pre-cooling helps because it creates in effect, a heat sink or a heat reservoir. Because now my body temperature at the start is 35.8. My muscles can still be warm. Again, this is why you wouldn't do it in an ice bath and then try and run because you'll have, you know, when you get cold joints, you can't even move them, never mind run like an elite athlete.
But you can have a cool upper body and warm legs.
That's the idea, yeah. And so that's proven to be actually moderately effective. There's a review article, senior author on which is a guy called Stephen Chung. Also, he's a Canadian, one of the leaders in the space. And their conclusion is that pre-cooling for endurance exercise actually works. It either cools you off before and then it allows you to get warmer at a slower rate. So you also got more room to play in.
Yeah.
So if we come back to what I mentioned earlier, if your off switch is 39.6 degrees, you want to start as far below 39.6 degrees as possible because it gives you more wiggle room, if that makes sense, more heating room.
Mm.
Yeah, so pre-cooling is probably third on the list of things you can do. Second is heat adaptation, which I think we've covered off.
Mm.
You just have to do the time. You just have to teach the body what it feels like. Interestingly, you can do that passively or actively.
Mm-hmm.
So what a lot of athletes have begun doing, and there's some interesting studies on this, is that they'll do their normal exercise in coolish conditions and then jump into a sauna for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And that 30 minutes heat exposure achieves the same kinds of things as 30 minutes of exercise heat exposure does. So there might be a way you can manipulate and play with those things if you've got the time and the money and the option. And finally, it's fitness.
Just taking a slight step back, I'm interested that you were saying that the ice vests, and it's just maybe a question that I've considered here. It feels like with those ice vests that you're just throwing like an ice block into a boiling kettle where it probably does work. But so the science has proven that there is a performance benefit, but the length of that benefit obviously is very difficult to determine because it's based on the size of the athlete and how hot they get, etc.
Right.
But so I was just questioning whether how much of an effect that would have. Obviously, it's marginal gains, as the some well-known cycling team has often said. But is it a marginal gain or is it a significant difference?
Well, so statistically, it's called a moderately statistically significant effect. That's literally from the paper that Stephen Chung has authored. But where it is a good question, and I have wondered this myself, is if I'm doing a marathon over the course of 2 hours and 4 minutes, by the time I've run 15 minutes, that ice vest is a distant memory.
Yes.
But to your body, it's not quite. So obviously, if I'm doing a 20-minute trial, you know, it's a 13K or a 15K time trial in Tour de France, now you can see there's a viable, direct way that it's going to help.
Could keep you cool, have an effect for the entire time trial.
It could literally get you to the finish line, still a degree or two cooler than you would have been, and because you started with a greater reserve, and you're warm, and your remember your skin is now, you've got this cooler blood, and there's this complex cardiovascular readjustment going on, blood to the skin coming back maybe a little bit cooler if the chest and so on's cooler, so there is some evidence that it actually helps you heat up slower.
Mm.
It delays the rate at which you overheat.
Mm.
And that effect can last for, let's go, 10K race potentially. But by the time you get to Attaquas, you know, 5.5-6 hours or 5 hour day in the Tour de France where you've got the last 45 minutes up Alpe d'Huez, Yeah, you probably aren't really. Yeah. So then in that situation, you're just managing perception. You're pouring cold water on your head like Matt was trying to do. By the way, you get like wearable coolables, things like neck collars that you can also pre... The problem is your neck is 8% of your body surface area. No, sorry, 1%. Your head is 8. So you can put like a cold helmet or hat on, or you can put a neck thing on. But then it is the drop in the ocean thing coming back to it, you know?
Interesting that, because Alberto Salazar famously won the 1991 Comrades Marathon wearing a neck towel. Yeah,
they were called coolets or something.
Something like that. But he absolutely maintained that the reason why he was able to, because he had an overheating problem, he maintained at that time.
Remember, he ran himself to last rites territory in that Boston Marathon.
True. Yes, he had experience.
And that was and so his was a name that this Douglas Kasser guy mentioned. He said, look at him, he's never been the same ever since. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted.
But he was an example of somebody that claimed this neck cooling system was the reason why he won the Comrades, which is held in very hot conditions. I was there on that day.
Yeah. I remember watching that as a kid. I think that those things have a perceptual benefit. And again, within normal physiological body temperature regulations, and now if we exclude that 1 in 5,000, whatever it is, who gets proper heat stroke, that perception is the most important thing for performance in the heat. So as long as you're wearing something like that you can keep cool, even if you're pouring water on your head every 5 to 10 minutes and that's cold water and it's keeping you cool, your performance will definitely be better than someone who doesn't do it just because you feel better.
Yeah.
And I sometimes like shake my head in amazement that my PhD boils down to like just make yourself feel better. But that's what it is. Like when you are trying to manage the physiology of performance, the way the athlete feels is the fundamental thing that underpins the performance. And so if we come back to exercise...
Does it go back to the governor theory then?
That's exactly where this goes to, yeah. So the governor theory, and again, my PhD was on this. By the time I wrote my PhD up, the governor theory had become so contentious as a black box model that no one wanted to use the word
anymore. For those who don't know what it is, maybe just explain what it means very quickly.
So Tim Noakes proposed this idea that instead of exercise failure and fatigue being the result of some system problem in your body, whether it was I ran out of energy, whether it was I couldn't get enough oxygen, or whether it was I got too hot, which is obviously the context of our discussion. The problem was actually that you were being regulated or governed to avoid those consequences from happening. So it's not that you run out of energy, it's that you slow down in order to not run out of energy. It's not that you ran out of oxygen, it's that you had to decrease your pace to protect yourself against running out of oxygen. And
your body was forcing you to do that.
Yeah, your brain. That's where the central component of the governor came in, is that the brain would sense what was happening to the body. So specifically with reference to the heat, because it is easily the best model to understand this. As the body got hotter and hotter, the brain would be monitoring this like a thermostat in an air conditioner and say, if we don't slow down, we are going to fail. Therefore, in order to not fail, I'm going to cause you to slow down. So the distinction between that and the catastrophic, Tim called it catastrophic. It's not always catastrophic as in death. But when I spoke earlier of the Scandinavians, they were observing that these runners and cyclists were falling off the treadmill or the bike, body temperature, 40 degrees Celsius, brain was losing, like the blood flow in the brain had dropped off compared to normal temperatures. They couldn't activate their muscles. They do this really nifty study where they make you do muscle contractions and then they stimulate through your skin and see how much force you can produce. And they found that it's not your muscles that are the problem, it's that your brain isn't sending the signal to the muscle.
That's a very clever study isn't it?
So yeah, that's what they did. So I'll tell you exactly what they did there. They make them ride hot or cold conditions for 60 minutes. Or exhaustion, whichever comes first. Straight off the bike, doing a 2-minute long maximum contraction of one muscle group. And sure enough, in those 2 minutes, once the brain is hot, you activate less muscle than when you're cool. So the hot brain is unable to activate muscle.
Yeah.
And when I stimulate the muscle independent of your brain, it works just fine. So it's not that the muscle has failed, it's that the central activation of the muscle has been dialed back. But the central governor goes even one step beyond that, because it's saying, we're not going to wait for the brain to get hot for that to happen. We're going to reduce that brain muscle signal in advance of getting hot. Does that make sense? It's a timing issue that distinguishes them. So we actually challenged the Scandinavian model. They were saying fatigue in the heat is the result of the attainment of a critical hyperthermia. In other words, we reach a body temperature beyond which we can no longer exercise. Our thinking was fatigue in the heat and underperformance happens because the brain anticipates a potential hyperthermia and then reduces the muscle activation to prevent that from happening. So the very first study I ever had published was a 20-kilometer cycling time trial, hot and cold. It was 35 degrees and 12 degrees. 35 degrees.
That's tough for the subjects.
And 15, yeah. And we made them do 20K time trials, and we measured body temperature, muscle activation, heart rate, RPE, all these skin temperatures and so on. And the most amazing thing is that within the first 2 kilometers, you slow down in the heat. But at that moment, so over the first 2Ks, no difference in heart rate, no difference in body temperature, no difference in rating of perceived exertion. So why did you slow down? Well, you slowed down because a combination of experience and physiology has taught you that I have to do 20Ks. If I don't slow down, I'm going to make 15. So very cleverly, we start to anticipate or forecast the future consequence of our present actions and then modify them to get and to the finish line.
And also consciously, I guess.
And consciously, because if you ask the person for perceived exertion, they could, or how they're feeling, they'll probably tell you, I'm really hot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's a thermal comfort that's probably driving it in a conscious way. And then subconsciously, we're not consciously dialing our muscle activation back by 9-10%, but that's just happening. So I ended up calling it anticipatory regulation of performance, because that's exactly what was happening, was you were regulating performance in anticipation of, in this case, overheating.
I suppose that begs the question, how do people like Jim Peters and Gabriel and Earl Eckrout get into the position that they do where they're suffering from essentially heat stroke?
That is the really important question. So first of all, the system that constrains us, the regulatory system, is quite robust. If it wasn't, every second person would get heat stroke.
Yeah.
Because at a local 10K Olympic marathon, let's forget local, at the Olympic marathon, at least 50% of the field is highly motivated.
Yeah.
So if motivation is all it took to break through that glass ceiling, half the race would fall over with heat stroke in a hot day, right? But they don't. Mm-hmm. So whatever's happening is quite robust, but it's not perfect. So a guy like Jim Peters in 1954, I assume it was a hot day. Los Angeles 1984 would have been hot in the summer in LA. The Gold Coast race with Hawkins, Callum Hawkins, was very hot. And last weekend with Matt Beers was hot. And we know there were a couple of cases there.
Mm.
With the right contexts, environments, and motivation, a highly motivated athlete can push themselves beyond the point at which the brain is able to save them from themselves, if that makes sense. So motivation, like Matt Beers was trying as hard as he could.
Mm.
He didn't die. He didn't even get heat stroke. So his body saved him. His brain saved him to fight another day. But there might be one or two people who don't quite get the signal, who are motivated that little bit more, or who just can't escape the situation quickly enough.
Mm.
Gabriella Anderson came 38th, I think, in that marathon. She wasn't racing for a medal.
No.
But I think at some point you're in the city of Los Angeles with baking heat, convection off the buildings. And you can't cool down. Even if she walked the rest of the race, she still would have got heat stroke.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably in play there. Yeah. And then finally, there might well be some metabolic problem. You know, when I tell that story about a guy in a bucket of ice who gets hotter and hotter for 30 minutes, that's not normal physiology.
That's outliers, and there are those.
That's a metabolic issue going on there. And the theory is you get something in animals called malignant hyperthermia, where basically there's a calcium receptor channel in the muscle, and it malfunctions, and it just churns heat. It just it goes haywire, basically. It's like a short circuit, and it just starts an internal fire.
Mm.
And you see this with animals under high stress conditions where they actually cook from inside. And so something's gone wrong there.
Yeah.
I've got a colleague studying what's called capture myopathy, where they go in the wild and they have to capture animals for conservation purposes. And a lot of the time they chase these animals to dart them, but the animal is so stressed out that it triggers this metabolic condition that, literally cooks them from within. So that so anyway, we don't know that to be true of humans, but we know that a lot of heat strokes happen without any explanation. A guy running a four-hour marathon at 10 degrees Celsius should not get heat stroke. It's impossible, yet they do. So there's some kind of condition where they just generate excessive internal heat, and that's what happened to the guy in the bathtub with ice. So yeah, that's the short answer.
So as much as many humans there are in the world, everybody's slightly different in the way they handle heat, and obviously there's those outliers that are
and
that don't conform to the norms.
So I suspect that there's some pathology, and that exercise and heat might be the trigger for that, and then once that's kicked in, you are in serious trouble. You know, in the same way that you get sudden cardiac deaths. So that's probably what it is. But the, I guess the point is, and coming back to what I began with, is perception makes the difference. So we slow down in the heat because we have a perception that it's hot. And if we want to, protect our heat performance, we would change that perception. There's a drug, by the way, and then I'll stop, called bupropion, which is commonly prescribed as an antidepressant, but it acts in the brain and it actually changes arousal levels, and that drug improves performance in the heat but not the cold. And the way that it does that is it takes away that feedback signal and the interpretation of that signal that would normally slow you down. So when you put these guys in the heat, they just exercise and, and they get to 41 degrees Celsius, whereas normally they'd have stopped at 40. And so it, it's almost like acts like a central nervous system.
Obviously quite dangerous, the results of that.
It? So it's banned, yes.
So we talked a lot about heat. Humidity is obviously what people talk about a lot when they talk about heat in those sort of circumstances. You can have 25 degrees Celsius with, you know, 50% humidity and it's fine. But if it's 100% humidity, obviously it changes. What do we know about the effects of humidity and heat versus just heat on its own?
Yeah, it's actually an oversight of mine to talk about heat when actually what I mean is heat index.
So heat, which combines humidity.
Yeah, so air temperature by itself is not the consideration. Obviously, that makes a difference when it's 40 degrees. But when it's 28 degrees and 90% humid, that's the same situation as maybe a 40 degrees.
Yeah.
So there's actually, there is something called the heat index. The National Weather Service of the U.S. produces it, and I'm looking at one right here. So I haven't done these conversions from Fahrenheit to Celsius, but we can make those. But for instance, 90 degrees Fahrenheit with 30% humidity has a is a heat index of 88. So it's lower than feels. So it feels cooler than it is.
Makes sense? That would be relatively mild.
Well, I mean, 90 is still hot. It's still warm, but it's like, but now consider 90 degrees with 95% humidity feels like 127 on the heat index. So that you can see, the point I'm making is that the swing caused by humidity is enormous. And that was why, that's why Olympic Games in summer are always so challenging, because they tend to be in hot and humid places. Athens, Beijing. Sydney was maybe one exception. Where was the last one? In Tokyo, same story.
So
you get this combination of heat and humidity. And that's the problem. Why is it a problem? Because we produce heat, obviously, during exercise through muscle contraction. And that's going to cause our body temperature to go up. We have to lose that heat. And that happens via three ways, but for exercise, two main ones. One is convection, which is air cooling. So that's why if you're cycling on your indoor without a fan, it feels 50% harder than with a fan on.
And that's just the air on your skin.
The movement of air over the skin removes the heat. And that's why we send the blood to the skin. That's the cutaneous skin vasodilation that I spoke of earlier, right? That creates that tension. And then the second one is evaporation of sweat. Now, sweat doesn't remove heat unless it evaporates. So when you drip that sweat off, like when you're watching the Australian Open tennis and the guy's bouncing the ball and you see a waterfall of sweat running off his nose and his face, that's not helping him. He has to evaporate the sweat. Obviously, you can't see that happening, but but the problem is humidity constrains evaporative capacity. So at some point, well, not at some point, but as the humidity goes up, the capacity of the environment to take that heat up as evaporation goes down.
So the drier the heat, the better your body's ability has to use sweat to cool it down.
Yes, exactly. Because, and in fact, that's why, and I'm looking again at this table, a temperature of 113 degrees Fahrenheit, which I need to just convert this. I should have done this before.
That's pretty hot.
That's very hot. 113 Fahrenheit is 45 degrees Celsius, right? Mm-hmm. With a humidity of 5% is equivalent to 104 Fahrenheit. But if that humidity goes up to 60%, it's 159.
Wow.
So that's the heat index.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now you see the point is.
So that's actually what you need to be, if you're judging heat impact.
Yeah.
That's what you should be looking at.
Correct. And actually, as I said, it was an oversight not to do that in the beginning. But everything I said in the first 50-odd minutes of this applies to heat index.
Yeah.
You know, so when we talk about an uncompensable heat environment, we're talking about the mix between humidity and temperature. And wind, by the way, because a still day is much more difficult than a windy day.
For sure.
Because there's less convective cooling. Mm. And sunlight. So that's the fourth avenue by which we gain heat. Sorry. That's the other avenue by which we gain heat. You can also lose heat through radiation, but the radiative heat from the sun makes a big difference.
Yeah. Being in the shade makes a difference.
As you've discovered practically. Yeah. Every human knows that. In fact, there's a clip of Jim Peters available, I think, online when he's collapsing in Vancouver and he's walking around the track and instinctively he finds the shade to collapse in.
Yeah.
It's amazing. You just know. So that's why, and there are literally hundreds of these indexes or indices, thermal indices, where they integrate air temperature, humidity, wind speed, and radiation, solar radiation. But most sports events will have some policy that recognizes the heat index. And the main ones are the humidity and the temperature. And they'll make decisions based on that.
Well, I was going to get onto that. So based on everything that we've said and using the example of this Atacos Extreme and other events that happen in very hot countries, it seems to me that there isn't a guideline or significant guideline in terms of heat and this heat index, that there is a standard across the world that says if the heat index is X, the event shouldn't be run. It seems a bit sort of scattered, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. And in defense of the non-existent uniformity or agreement, there is some interesting research where the incidence of heat stroke is highest at the beginning of a season than in other parts of the season, which is because of adaptation driving the outcome.
Coming out of winter.
Right. So it's that transition from cool to hot. Again, I mentioned earlier the American football in their preseason training camps, you know, which happen in their late summers, I guess, because it's a winter sport there, right? Mm. They go from not training to training in full gear and so on. Even though they're coming from a hot environment, it's the heat stress of that equipment in that instance. London Marathon often has problems because it's run in April and no one's adapted yet. So 26 degrees in London can be a bad day out.
Yeah.
In South Africa, 26 degrees, Matt Beers is laughing all the way to the finish line, right? Because he's dealt with 46.
Absolutely.
So in actual fact, that's probably an argument against a single cutoff point, because you have to be nuanced about who's participating in this, what time of year is it, how adapted are they likely to be. So that makes it quite tricky to actually have one definitive statement.
So you're suggesting the heat policy is almost impossible to implement?
No, I don't
think. As a guideline, because I was a race organizer, like the guys at Atacos,
yes,
surely I would have, in the morning of the race, gone and consulted somebody who says, well, maybe we shouldn't have this race today.
Yeah, if you consulted me, I said, thanks.
But would you have said no?
Yeah.
Would you?
Yeah, at start line temperatures at what, like 35 degrees with anticipating 50? No way. There's not a combination of heat index and heat, temperature and humidity in the world.
There would be low humidity, don't forget there.
That's the one saving grace. But still, 50 degrees is 50 degrees.
Yeah. So that's interesting, because as a sports scientist, with the knowledge that you have, you would have given them advice, say, you should cancel the race today.
Maybe not cancel, but if you're going to let people go in those circumstances, you have to be very, very clear that you're going to provide avenues for people to cool off along the way. Because once they leave that start block and the 121K later, because this is point to point, eh?
Yes.
That's the problem. In
you Atacos. Can't do a shortcut.
There's nowhere to escape it.
Yeah.
So you'd, if I was a race organizer there, I'd be thinking like every 20Ks, I need some kind of refrigeration. I need big tubs with ice water that I can keep cold, because I'm almost sure that 50 people out of my 600 starters are going to need to jump in there. You told me stories of friends of yours that were finding streams to lie down in.
Yeah.
Now, that's the kind of mitigation strategy you would need. So, for example, right now, Australian Open tennis is on. they've to some extent solved this problem by putting a roof on the main arenas in the last couple of years. But do you remember 5-6 years ago, they always had heat issues.
Yeah.
And so they developed a policy where there are five levels, one, two, three, four, and five. One is nothing. Two is encourage people to drink, which is useless. But by the time you get to four and five, level five is we cancel all games. They don't play. And level four is after the second set in women's matches and the third set in men's matches, we have a 10-minute break where everyone can go in, cool off, and come back out again. So there's mitigation strategies that you can at least put in place. Mm. Gold Coast Marathon policy I was able to find. Once the temperature is 26, they consider that to be high risk and they introduce more water stations and medical personnel.
At 26 degrees Celsius?
26 degrees or higher. And
that's just based on temperature only.
Yeah, and they also say humidity exceeds 60%.
Right.
From 30 and above, it's extreme, and they say cancellation and postponement.
Wow.
Yeah. So, anyway, you get the idea, is that...
I mean, I can just think off the top of my head, you know, four or five events that have well exceeded 30 degrees Celsius, events that I participated
right.
in, Ironman events, you know, events here in South Africa that are well beyond that extreme level, yeah. with none of those mitigation strategies in place at all.
And that's why... That's why you would want to... So in answer to your question earlier, every event should consider its own context to develop some sort of guidelines. But you can't have a guideline that covers all events. Because even in South Africa, an event in March would be safe where an event in September would not at the same temperatures.
Yeah.
Because in March, for South Africans, you're coming after your fourth month of summer. Most people will handle 30 degrees Celsius. Mm. In August, 30 degrees Celsius will be potentially very dangerous for us. The inverse is true in the Northern Hemisphere. An event in March is probably, for them, very unsafe.
Yeah.
The same event in September would be safer. So it depends. Latitude affects it. You know, what happens in the southern states of the United States will be different to what's safe in the northern states because of what they're accustomed to. So you have to sort of know your audience a little bit. And then also know the time of year and then understand your event.
See, not to harp on about this, but a couple of years ago, I did an event London to Paris. And the first leg is from London to the coast of Folkestone before you go across to Paris. And it was the hottest day in British history. I think temperatures were like 42 degrees Celsius on that day. And I felt that on that day that they should have cut that race short because it wasn't a race designed for high-end athletes. It was a lot of people who were just out there for a touring event. But the extreme temperatures were high risk and they did not have the resources to look after
That's the key.
Multiple emergencies.
Mm. Mm. That's the key, right?
Mm. Which is the reason why I maybe think about having this index is so critical.
Mm.
Having some sort of guideline like they do with the British, like they have with the Australian Open, where there is a 1 to a 5. Everybody around the world understands that when you're in that sort of territory, you need to consider some different strategy.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can appreciate, obviously, the practical dilemma for the organizers is that there's no substitute day.
Yeah.
And so they would lose considerable. So it's a business decision, actually.
Yeah.
Weighed up against a human, potentially, decision.
Mm.
But you're right. I mean, every event should have some sort of policy in place. And if they're not going to ever cancel it, fine. But then you have to have some pretty well thought through necessary mitigation procedures, you know. And as I say, the best thing is buckets of ice for people to get into and cool off when there's a problem. And that needs to be every 10, 20K or so because that's every hour. If you're on a bike at 46 degrees Celsius and you start running into problems, half an hour is too long to wait.
Yeah.
So you need need access to cooling really, really quickly. So at the very least, events should have a plan that says when it reaches this level, we're going to have that facility available.
I mean, to challenge you, I know that you obviously a lot of your day job is working for World Rugby.
Mm.
Is there a heat policy around rugby matches?
They've never had to think of one because it's a winter sport that's never been played in hot places.
Mm.
Now that, interestingly,
it's become a year-round sport though, hasn't it?
Well, because now there's a new – non-rugby followers wouldn't maybe realize this, but – in the last 2 or 3 years, South African teams have begun to play in the European competition. So now all of a sudden, for the first time, we have a cross-hemisphere competition.
Mm.
And the consequence is that those European teams would have to come here now. I mean, imagine coming out of Glasgow or Edinburgh or London on the 17th of January and landing in Cape Town yesterday.
So maybe that's going to be your next task.
So what they have done is we've got some rugby tournaments that happen in the early part of the year when it's quite hot, and they allow a 20-minute break. Sorry, they allow a break at 20 minutes of each half, which is halfway through the half.
Mm.
Football has got the same thing on hot days. They had it in the Euros last year, I believe, and it'll definitely be in play at the World Cup later this year, where they also have a what they call a cooling break midway through each of the halves.
Mm.
So they have thought about that. And yeah, out of interest, intermittent sprint exercise is quite dangerous heat-wise, because you're exercising at a high enough intensity when you sprint to really elevate your body temperature, but you're doing it over the course of 90 minutes. So your exposure is high and your intensity is high.
Yeah, there's no
so they can actually be quite a problem. So that will be interesting to see what FIFA decides. I mean, the main thing they did with Qatar is to put it in November. I mean, if it was in June, July, it'd be unplayable.
Without the World Athletics Championships in Doha, when they had the marathon at midnight,
And remember, the athletes were still collapsing all over the place.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's another example. I mean, that's why this heat thing's so interesting. You see it in play all the time.
Mm.
Remember, there were hardly any heat strokes. There were lots of heat exhaustions and collapsed athletes, and athletes who just had the worst day of their professional running careers.
Yeah.
But you didn't hear of, like, two 24 marathon runners ended up in hospital in ICU as a consequence. The body is smart, but we also have to be sensible. Like I say, any fool can suffer.
Yeah.
But event organizers have to take every precaution to minimize that suffering and the consequences of it. And that's where I think you need a policy per event, you know? I tried, by the way, to look up exactly what makes a level 4 in the Australian Open tennis and 5, and I couldn't find it. What's the combination of humidity and temperature?
But if you were given the task of saying, with your background in history, and somebody said to you, okay, we've got a cycling event in South Africa in the middle of summer, and we've got a marathon in the spring in London, could you devise a strategy for those two events? Is that a relatively simple thing to do if you look at the timings and where it is and the history and humidity factors and that sort of thing?
It's not simple, but it sure is possible. It would make an interesting project.
Yeah.
What would my approach be? I would look at the historical weather data for the 2 months leading up to it, and I would probably, instead of saying 30 degrees is dangerous, I would say average temperature over the last 3 weeks plus 6. I don't know, I'm making this up now, don't quote me on this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So if the average temperature in London is 18, maybe 24 becomes our level 2.
Right.
Maybe 28, which is plus 10, becomes our level 3, and over 30 becomes our level 4.
Yeah.
And so you make that decision based on what most of your athletes would be habituated to. You can never mitigate the guy who comes from the freezing cold climate to run in the – I mean, you can't.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would – based on historical data, what it's been like, and then what is it on the day. Just incidentally, your ability to lose heat to the environment, as I've mentioned, is a function of humidity and air temperature. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Humidity, because at a certain point, you can no longer evaporate enough sweat to cool you down. Evaporation capacity drops. Where it's interesting is the air temperature, because we can warm our skins up in order to keep a gradient between ourselves and the environment. So if the air temperature is 18 degrees and my skin is 28, I'm losing nice heat, you know, 10 degree difference between myself and the air.
Mm-hmm.
As the air gets warmer and warmer, we can get our skin temperature higher and higher, but at some point that reaches a limit. And that limit is at about 35 degrees. So that's about as hot as our skin can get.
Yeah.
So the moment the air temperature hits 35, it means that our skin and the air are the same. And we can no longer lose heat through convection.
Yeah.
And so then the only avenue we've got is evaporation. Mm. Now if the humidity hits 60%, that disappears. So if you want a start point, 35 degrees with 50-60% humidity is probably the limit for endurance exercise.
Makes total sense.
And then you work down from there and you say, what can we get away with here?
Fascinating stuff. Thank you very much, Professor Ross Tucker. Really interesting discussion. And for those of you that might be freezing in Europe somewhere, keep a note of this podcast when your summer hits, because it sure will be very useful when you're having to deal with the very hot temperatures. And for those of you that live in the southern hemisphere, particularly in South Africa over the last week, I'm sure you will have experienced a lot of the things that we've discussed in our discussion today. Don't forget, you can be part of our discussion on our Twitter feed, which is SportsCiPod, sports and then SCIPOD. And let us know about your experiences of heat. And we've had bad experiences, good experiences, lessons learned, anything like that. We're always very interested to hear some of your thoughts around our discussions. But from us, for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsCiPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.